Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Joining me right now is U.S. Senator Gary Peters, who's in town, gave the commencement address over at Michigan Tech. Senator, good to have you back.
Always great to be with you, Rick.
Let's start right there. You had a chance to be able to talk to the graduates that are leaving Michigan Tech, heading out into the real world. What'd you have to say to them?
Well, first off, congratulate him on graduating from what's really just an outstanding university. Michigan Tech is just an incredible leader when it comes to technology and research. But my message to them is that as they are going to be at the cutting edge of this new frontier of technology, from synthetic biology to self-driving cars to nanobots, they also have to serve the community to make sure that we're able to remember the human element of all these technologies and what sort of impact they have on our daily lives.
The work that they are doing over there, some of the research is pretty amazing. It was a couple of commencements ago that the speaker talked about how the children of those that were graduating may never have a driver's license. And I don't know, that's kind of optimistic, I think, maybe in a way, but it is pretty amazing to think that that could be on the horizon.
Well, I think it is. I've been working on legislation related to that in Washington, D.C. It's very important for the auto industry here in Michigan to make sure that we're the center of it. And these technologies, the thing that is really most exciting about self-driving, and before we even get to fully self-driving, the technologies for safety are increasing dramatically. But at some point, engineers believe we can eliminate most auto accidents, given the fact that 95% of auto accidents are human error. And if you can eliminate that, you'll eliminate those accidents. And at a time when nearly 40,000 people die on our highways every year, it literally will save tens of thousands of lives.
Recently bought the newest car I've had in a while. It's only a couple of years old, so it comes with a lot of bells and whistles mm-hmm. that I haven't seen. Of course, it's nothing as advanced as self-driving, but just being amazed with something as a backup camera, wasn't on a vehicle that I had before. And wow, how did I ever get by without something like this? The advancements are amazing.
Right, exactly. So you have that. And even before the full self-driving, when you get some of the radar and LiDAR will keep you away from hitting the car in front of you, it'll immediately react. As humans, it takes us a little while before the brake light goes on and before we put the brake, or if it's a slippery conditions, it leads to fender benders. But now with LiDAR, the brakes are immediately applied as soon as there's any kind of slowing. So, I mean, it's those kinds of features will change the way we drive forever.
During your time up here in northern Michigan and the UP, you took some time out to hop over the river and go over to Marinette for the, mm-hmm. the marine plant over there. And what was your experience?
Well, I wanted to get there to see their operations directly. I serve on the Senate Armed Services Committee in Washington that oversees the military and appropriations for new weapon systems. They build the Littoral Combat Ship, which is a smaller ship that gets in closer, high speed, uses jet propulsion, basically, a very versatile platform. But that ship is coming to the end of its production, and the shipyard is going to need to produce new ships in order to stay open. The Navy will be putting out a contract for a frigate, which is a larger ship than the Littoral Combat Ship, and hopefully they will win that contract, because those are important jobs for both Michigan and Wisconsin. It's right on the border, as you know. But about half the employees there live in Michigan.
I'm kind of a fan of history, and I enjoy watching historical footage, and some of that is some of our military operations. And with your background in the U.S. Navy, I was wondering your thoughts on the role in our Navy as warfare and defense of the country continue. Seems that sea battles, as we may know them from like World War II footage, those things, not as prevalent as they used to be. What is the importance of having a strong Navy going forward?
Well, the strong Navy is about keeping the lines of commerce open all across the globe. So you can have pirate actions. You can have other countries with diesel submarines that can interfere with it. But we also have large countries. The Chinese, for example, are building a Navy. They're aggressively building their Navy. And if there was ever a conflict with the Chinese over, let's say, the islands that they're building in the South China Sea and counter to international law, you would potentially see those kinds of naval battles as well come back.
Hmm. All right. We're going to kind of stick, I guess, a little bit with some maritime theme here. And just with the Sioux Locks, mm-hmm. President Trump was in Michigan recently here. He talked about the Sioux Locks and their importance that something be done. And it's been a long process here trying to get the, especially perhaps the Pollock renovated or new lock built. Right. And we see a little bit of movement here and there, but how far away are we from a major project?
Well, I hope we're close. We've been pushing it aggressively, and the way we've been pushing it recently is we were able, and I was able to get money for a study that the Army Corps needs, because they basically prioritize projects all across the country. It's done in an objective way, and you score it based on studies. And the study that the Army Corps did in the past was flawed, and they actually admitted the flaw. And I say it was flawed because it didn't really consider the fact if the locks go down, the incredible negative impact it has on the economy, not just in Michigan, but all across the country. In fact, the Department of Homeland Study did a study that showed if the locks were closed from 90 days plus, it could actually lead to a recession for the whole economy if that iron ore is not moving and other raw materials. The Army Corps of Engineers had a flawed study because they just assumed that material could get to the mills some other way, by train or by truck. It's clear we don't have enough trucks to move the kind of material that these ore freighters carry. And it's also clear we don't have enough rail cars. And even if they were brought down by rail car to the steel mills, all of the loading material comes off of a ship, not off of a rail car. They'd have to rebuild infrastructure. It would delay the delivery of raw materials for manufacturing in this country by a considerable amount. I believe that Army Corps study will show that. It'll show that this is a priority. And we're expecting to have it released probably within the next month or two. And when that happens, I believe this will be a clear priority for the Army Corps to invest in.
Is there a goal as far as time to get this done by 2020 or beyond that?
Well, the construction, the design, and the construction will take a few years. So the goal is to get them working on it as soon as possible in the next year or two, if we can get that done. And then construction will proceed. But it, you know, could be a 5-6 year project with the construction.
Is the money available for it?
There is money for projects, big projects, but they have to fit the criteria of being prioritized, because you can't do all the projects that need to be done around the country. So the money is being spent on those that are viewed as the most essential. And I believe this report, when we get it out and they correct the flaws that were clear that we identified, that it'll show that this is a priority.
All right. Well, hopefully we get a new lock before we get a wall.
So. Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you on that.
All right. Let's move on to some of the things that you've been working on. The last time that we met, we talked about some legislation that you introduced that was called the Youth Act. It was designed to help battle the opiate problem. And I wanted to see if you can give us an update. First, I guess, fill out our listeners in on what that legislation does.
Well, it deals with the opioid crisis that we're facing all across this country. Every community is being impacted by it. And in Congress, we've been working to provide additional resources for local governments. We've did that in our most recent budget bill that passed. But I was focused on one area in particular, and that was adolescents who have been are really victims of an opioid addiction. And yet, some of the most effective treatments for that, which is called Medicaid-assisted treatment, basically a physician prescribes other drugs to you to wean you off of your addiction, and you're able to then move forward. But those were only available for adults, 18 and over. And every physician we talked to said there's no reason why an adolescent, a 15, 16, or 17-year-old, can't use these treatments, and they'll be very effective. And this is not just an adult problem. This is an adolescent problem as well. And so the legislation I drafted actually passed out of that, a big part of that language, to create a best practices program where we can start looking at using these Medicaid-assisted treatments for adolescents. That has now passed out of Senate committee. And it now goes to the full Senate floor, and we're looking to hopefully move it soon.
Good. Yeah, our area has been hard hit. I know a lot of areas have, but I think maybe in the rural areas, the areas that maybe struggle a little bit more, that opiates, especially over the last decade or so, has became so available, became sort of the drug of choice, mm-hmm. and has forced our local law enforcement and municipalities to have to shoulder the burden of battling this epidemic. There were some lawyers from downstate up here recently talking about trying to recoup some of that money from from drug companies that they say push these drugs and wanted them to be available, and now we're all sort of paying the price, trying to recoup some of the costs that the municipalities and local areas have to pay in order to battle this problem.
It is. It's a big problem for municipalities. I was in a county recently. It's kind of a partial suburban rural, but mostly rural county. And I was there visiting them to talk about their 911 systems and some improvements that we're looking at doing in my committee to make it work better. But the thing they told me was just striking was that if you look at opioid overdose calls that they get in to 911 in their county, that 2 to 3 years ago, they may have had one, maybe two a year, and now they have nearly one a day. I mean, it's amazing what's happening.
Yeah, definitely.
It's horrible.
One of the things that the current administration is say that they're attempting to do is sort of balance the playing field when it comes to trade, and that's supposed to be the motivation behind some of the tariffs that were enacted. You met with actually President Trump,
yeah.
And you brought up an idea that you had, a bipartisan bill that was also, I guess, could be phrased as trying to level the playing field.
Absolutely. And you mentioned President Trump invited me among 20 legislators were invited to the White House to talk about trade issues. I was one of the four Democrats that was invited as a senator. And what I talked to him about was legislation that I'm working on in a bipartisan way with one of my Republican colleagues from North Carolina that will allow the Commerce Department to self-initiate actions. That means bring trade actions against countries that we know are engaged in unfair competition. You know, I believe if we have fair competition, we can beat anybody. We have the best workers anywhere in the world, but the level playing field is absolutely critical for that. And so this would allow smaller industries to have the federal government go to bat against countries that are violating trade rules. And I'll give you an example because it's impacting us here in Michigan right now. We have a situation with our cherry growers and our tart cherry growers who are primarily in the Traverse City area, as you know. It's a big, one of the largest areas for tart cherries in the country. But the Turkish government is dumping cherry juice from tart cherries at prices that they are incredibly low. There's no way they can produce them at that low a price in Turkey, and it's forcing growers out of business. So the cherry business in Traverse City, the home of the Cherry Festival, is actually being impacted by these unfair practices. But there's no way these growers have the money to hire the army of lawyers and economists you need to bring a trade action. They need the federal government to step up and let the Turks know that this is simply unacceptable, and my legislation will make that happen.
What is dumping? I had to look it up myself. I didn't know when I first read it.
So the dumping is basically when you take a product, let's take the tart cherry product, and you sell it into the U.S. market at a price that is well below what it costs to actually produce. So it's not fair competition. You know, if they produce cheaper than American growers, then we have to become more competitive and you have to be able to make your processes work better. But if they're just dumping, which means they know they're taking a big loss on it, and really their real objective is to push other people out of business, and then as soon as American growers aren't around, you know that price is just going to come right back up again. So consumers are not going to be benefited by it. There'll be actually less competition when they get done, and you'll impact and potentially destroy an American business in the process. And that's simply something I will never tolerate and will keep fighting against.
It sounds very similar to some of our own commerce laws, too. And you can't have gas stations across from each other price fixing, or you can't, there are protections there for consumers just for these kinds of practices that are sort of meant to put somebody just out of business and then monopolize the market.
That's exactly right. I mean, the American economic system works best with robust competition, but it's got to be fair competition. And when people are breaking the rules, particularly if it's being subsidized, if you have a foreign government that's subsidizing that product with the intent to basically get into the U.S. marketplace and do damage to our local businesses and workers, that's something we cannot tolerate and won't tolerate.
What was the president's response to this?
Well, actually, he was, I think his actual, after I laid out my case, I think his actual response was, that's a fantastic idea. And I think he pounded the table, too, so I like that. And then he turned to Wilbur Ross, who's the Secretary for Commerce, and said, "Hey, Wilbur, are you on that?" And Wilbur said, "Of course I am." So it was a productive way to move the bill forward, and we're hoping to get action on it soon.
Okay, good. All right, let's talk about next thing. We've had this discussion too with broadband in rural areas, and you're familiar with something that is, if it's out of sight, it's out of mind. Now, I live in the Calumet area, so not a major populated area, but I have got broadband internet service at my house.
You do.
It's great. It's actually pretty nice.
Yeah.
Don't mind it at all. I got it through Charter.
Right.
And the reason why I bring that is because I have it. A lot of residents, they have high speed internet, so they don't see this as a problem because they have it.
Right.
But when we talk to businesses trying to relocate in this area, especially if they're maybe not going to be one of the downtown centers, it is a huge issue and a an obstacle to relocating or investing in the area.
There's no question. You have to have access to high-speed broadband internet if you're a business person. And if you have a residential home, you're going to want access to be able to tie into all the benefits of having high-speed internet. I really say it's akin to electricity in the last century, is that, you know, we made a decision last century that electricity, even though it's a lot more expensive to run a line out to a rural community than it is in a city, we made a commitment as a country that everybody in this country should have access to electricity. It was what we did, and we built the program around it. Today, broadband, high-speed internet is the same thing. If you're not connected to that, if you're not connected to the world and you can't download material quickly and do business through that, you're in trouble. In fact, I was at another county recently, and they said you can, if you look at building permits for new residential homes and business startups, part of their county has high-speed internet, the other part doesn't. And you can just look at the numbers, they speak for themselves. If you have high-speed internet, new houses are being built, businesses are being created. If you don't, those counties are stagnant. So this, we have to build this out across the country.
You get into an area here where you have the government providing money or subsidies or building infrastructure that private companies can take advantage of. And some people say that may be the government overstepping, and they should let the market take care of that.
Well, you do need to subsidize, because the market won't take care of it in the rural areas, because you can't build as good a market case for it. As I gave the example for electricity, if you're going to run an electric line, it makes sense to draw an electric line to a place where there's 20 houses. It doesn't necessarily make economic case to take one line out to one house that's 30 miles out of town and put that one line in. You can't recoup that economically in a normal business model. And if we are of the belief that rural areas are entitled to basic services like electricity and telephone service and rural broadband high-speed internet, then we have to be able to make that happen and make a kind of investment necessary for people.
For somebody on the Commerce Committee, I can see why this would be important to you. Others may point out that there's a lot of other infrastructure that could probably use the money before we worry about broadband. I mean, we've got a number of communities that need their water systems addressed, and then we still have our regular infrastructure with our roads and bridges that still need to be addressed and other things. So when you're prioritizing money, as we talked about with the locks earlier, right, where does broadband fall into that priority list?
Well, I think it's very high on the list. And although obviously roads and bridges and water systems are critical, but rural broadband is not just a luxury. It's not just a frill. We talked about businesses don't locate somewhere. The way to grow an economy is to have businesses that can make money in your local community. And if they can't show up in your community because you don't have rural broadband, you're not going to be able to afford the sewer systems or roads or bridges. We have to grow the economy. And I'm very concerned, if you look throughout the United States, the economies that are growing robustly are urban areas, and rural areas are being hurt all over this country. And I want to believe if you want to live here and certainly here up in the Upper Peninsula, which is in my mind is God's country, it's absolutely gorgeous up here. The quality of life is amazing. But you do need to have some tools so that you can also make a good living. And part of that is rural broadband, high-speed internet to do that. I think this will be an attraction, and you'll see people not leaving the area and people coming to the area and continuing to grow this economy, which is in everybody's best interest.
So has money been set aside for this so far? Do we have a plan in place?
There is money now for rural broadband, and we're trying to fix some of the impediments to it. And I'll bring up one example. Part of the money that's available goes to areas that don't have coverage, don't have high-speed coverage. The problem is our maps are terrible as to what area has coverage and what areas don't. And part of it is we're relying on information from companies. And companies, when they market their services, you look at their map, they have coverage everywhere. It's great coverage everywhere. Until you're driving in your car and you look at your phone and there are no bars whatsoever on the phone. And you'll say, you know, I don't understand. That map says I have coverage, but I don't. The problem is some of our programs to help those areas we can't use because the companies are reporting we got great service in that area. So we are now working to to have a way in which we can have more accurate mapping as to what counties have high speed, which ones don't, and to what level is the service.
I guess it might make sense for the company to say that if they want to say that they have a wider coverage than they actually do. It makes them look better. I guess the bottom line looks better, but that doesn't actually help deliver the service to the customers.
No, it doesn't. And they're really trying to sell services to into urban areas and others and saying, you know, buy our service. Look at, we're covering all of Michigan. Buy our service versus somebody else. They're not necessarily marketing to a rural county somewhere.
Sure. All right, let's talk about another item that you have. You're trying to give some relief for those that have had student loans and some difficulty, I guess, maybe paying those student loans back and they've fallen into default. You know, I've been there. You know, yeah. I've went to college, had student loans, got out of college, didn't have a job for a while. And luckily now I think that there's some programs that help you in that situation. But, you know, I understand, you know, you can take a hit that, you know, if it's certainly something that ends up in your credit report, if you've been in default. And those kind of troubles can stick around for years before you get them corrected.
Absolutely. And it's a problem. And it's certainly appropriate. We're talking about this right after the commencement at Michigan Tech, because a lot of those students are going to have debt as they get out. And what we find, as you mentioned, what happens is a student, if you don't get a job right away, you still have to make your student loan payments. They come due. You have to start making those payments. Or like most of us, your first job doesn't pay as much as something later. You're just getting your foot in the door, and it makes it difficult to make those payments. So if you look at defaults on student loans, they tend to occur when students first come out. And then they start paying, which you have to. You can never get out of a student loan. But now they have it on their credit report that they had a default. And if you have that on your credit report, it's hard to rent a car. It's hard to buy a car. It's hard to rent an apartment. You have this blemish on your credit report, and because you stumbled a little bit when you first came out of school. So legislation that I was able to get in, a bill that just passed out of the Senate and now goes to the House, and we're hoping it'll be put into law shortly, says if you're in that situation and you go to the bank and the bank cuts you a deal to say, okay, you can start repaying your debts, and they may adjust those payments too based on your income. So if they give you a payment plan and you start making payments on that plan, then it's taken off your credit report as if it never happened. So it's really basically a second chance for folks to get on their feet, clear their credit report, and move on with their life.
And I guess that's an important distinction. If your loans are federal loans, there is some protections for you as well, but private loans do not have that protection.
That's right. So this deals, actually, the federal loans work very similar to what I just described. But many students have private loans, and this would allow those students who have those private loans the same kind of second chance that they would get with a federal loan.
And it's not a permanent get-out-of-jail-free card type of thing. It's, you can do this once. Either way, whether they're a federal one or if your bills were to pass and become law, it gives you that one chance to, you know,
one get chance back on to your feet. Have a second chance.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we got a couple of minutes left here. I want to just talk about some of the things that are going on in our national news real quick, because I got somebody that's got front row seat there in Washington. We've mentioned about the tariffs already, but let's talk about the tax bill and the effects of it, because we're coming out of our first tax season after the tax bill had gone into effect. And now I know that there's a lot of controversy over it. I could only speak for myself. I came out of it doing much better than I had in the previous years. Are you seeing people's opinions start to change now that they're getting their tax returns and filing their taxes, and about the effect and the some of the predictions of what the results of the tax bill would be?
Well, you know, it's still early to see what will happen. Certainly, folks will have benefits as a result of reduced taxes. It's important to remember, though, that 80% of all that benefit goes to the folks at the very top, the top 1% of all income folks. So if you're a wealthy person, you're extremely excited about the tax cut, because you're getting a massive tax cut. And what's happening as a result of that, we have now added $1.5 to $2 trillion in debt to our deficit. And so we can't maintain a strong economy in this country if we keep going into debt and the federal government keeps racking up huge, huge deficits. And that's what this tax bill did. It provided massive tax cuts for the wealthiest in our country. It put us in debt for trillions of dollars that all of us are going to end up paying for, and our children and grandchildren. And if you look at some of the major cuts, they basically went to corporations who have said, in fact, they were very open about this even as the the bill was being discussed, they weren't going to create jobs. They weren't going to invest in plant and equipment. They were going to increase dividends to shareholders and do share buybacks, which help the wealthiest in our country. And that's exactly what they're doing right now. And so it is a very uneven benefit. I wanted to support a tax reduction strategy that helps middle-class families, focused completely on middle-class families and those who aspire to the middle class, not focused primarily on major corporations and the wealthiest.
Okay. I wish we had a whole lot of time to talk about this. I just want to get your thoughts real quick, because we're seeing some movement with North and South Korea, and our president is saying that he had a big influence on that. I have a son who was in the Army until his recent passing, and one of my concerns was he going to be involved in another conflict? And when the Korean tensions began, I was concerned about that. Are we seeing an honest movement there by North Korea to give up their nuclear program and change the ways that they've been doing things?
I think it's hard to say. I think we can all hope that that's the case, but Kim Jong-un hasn't been ever an honest broker. He's never been one to stand by his word. But we obviously talks are better. You need to talk and hopefully get that kind of resolution, because having a North Korea with a nuclear weapon and ballistic missiles that can reach the United States is something that is simply unacceptable. But hopefully he will have changed. I know that the Chinese have also put significant pressure on the North Koreans. They've not done that in the past because they see this as incredibly destabilizing for the region as well. So hopefully times are different now than they were in the past. But I'm one of those guys that say I'll wait to see the results. Certainly encourage talk, but I'm not going to believe it till I see it. And it's demonstrated that he's actually standing behind his word.
Senator, I appreciate your time coming in today. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Cover Country Today. We'll be right back.